Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I have no idea whether it wins votes or loses votes. I don't have. What I know is, having 37 million people in the richest nation on the planet wake up every day worried about feeding and clothing their children is wrong. And we have a moral responsibility to do something about it.
Democratic presidential hopeful John Edwards from his speech last night at Cooper Union, which was followed by an interview that I did with him. It was great to see so many of you there. They did fill up the Great Hall in the East Village. It holds about 900 people. So, yes, New York does care. Certainly this audience cares about what's going on in the world, even on a beautiful Thursday night in New York. And as we mentioned here during the week, that speech was part of a series created by former Governor Mario Cuomo for presidential candidates to go into real depth on selected issues. For Edwards, it was poverty and the middle class, his signature issues. He returned to his signature theme of the Two Americas from the 2004 campaign. And the evening included what turned out to be brief remarks by Edwards, who was delayed and got there really late, and then our follow-up interview on the topic. Governor Cuomo did a great job of giving a speech off the cuff to fill some of the waiting time. He was really masterful at ad-libbing with substance and wit, which I guess is, you know, part of how you get as far as he got in the world of politics and public affairs. And I thank Governor Cuomo again for inviting me to conduct the interview portion of the event last night. And that's what we will re-air. Here is most of my interview with John Edwards. I began by asking him if it's true what I read, that his goal is not just to reduce poverty, but to end it altogether by the year 2036. Is it?
It is.
How would you measure the end of poverty? How would we know it when we saw it?
Well, that's a good question. Today, the federal government has a method for measuring whether a family falls above or below the poverty line that's fairly arbitrary and to a certain extent out of date. It's based on a standard that was established decades ago and was largely based on things like food prices. Did not take into consideration the whole realm of costs and income that families are confronted with today. So I think that way of measuring is out of date. I think if a family is able to support itself, to live a reasonable standard of living, save a little bit of money. I mean, I think that's a much more meaningful standard for whether a family's living in poverty or not.
Is it really possible?
I think it's above. By the way, I think that 37 million figure is probably wrong. It's very hard to gauge which way it's wrong, but I think the odds are overwhelming that it's wrong because it just doesn't take into consideration the other factors.
Is it really possible to wipe out poverty entirely, or is that something that's utopian that Americans should be wary of and be holding on to their tax wallets with?
No, I think, first of all, I think that we have to make a national commitment to do it. We have to recognize that giving people a chance to help themselves and lift themselves out of poverty says something about the character of America. That if we stand silently by and let situations like what we saw in the lower Ninth Ward of New Orleans after the hurricane hit continue, that does not say good things about us as a nation, that we're better than that. I believe we're better than that. And are you going to let me say what I think we ought to do about it?
Would you say what you think we ought to do about it?
Yeah, thank you. I think there are several things. I'll try not to get too much in the weeds, but the way I think about eliminating poverty, there are several components to a comprehensive plan. One is making work pay for all those families who are working. Another is having access to decent and affordable housing. Another is making sure they have health care coverage. Another is making sure that anybody who wants to go to college in this country gets a chance to go to college. Another is doing something. I talk about the two Americas, but doing something about the two public school systems that we still have in America. And I spoke earlier about, I won't go into this again, but you know, the fact we need to help families build assets that don't have any assets. It's not just an income piece. the financial consideration. It's also families being able to own a house, to be able to have a bank account, to have something to fall back on when times get lean. And the other I think important piece is the other thing that I would say.
Okay, folks, you know what? If you don't mind, probably just about everyone in this room agrees with you. So,
just so you know what's going on here, at this point in the event last night, there were a group of people who stood up and started chanting, "Impeach Bush, impeach Bush." They were quickly ushered out by security, but it was an interesting moment in a crowd in Lower Manhattan at the Great Hall of Cooper Union, where, as I said to them from the stage, probably almost everyone in the audience did already agree with them. But there you go. This is what happens sometimes at live events.
Welcome to New York.
You mean this doesn't happen in North Carolina?
Oh, I know it happens in North Carolina and other places around the country. People have very good reason to be worried about, concerned about this president, so
that's
I understand
right.
it.
We believe in free speech in New York City.
Yeah, I do too. So do I.
I want to ask you a few questions based on the New York Times Magazine cover story about you by Matt Bai. Did you read it last week?
Yes.
How much media can one candidate consume?
Exactly.
I guess when it's the New York Times Magazine cover, you read it. He wrote that what we call poverty has changed strikingly since the Great Depression or LBJ's war on poverty, that in 1929, the average income in today's dollars was about $16,000 a year, making the entire middle class of that day poor by today's standards. In Johnson's day, he wrote, there were rural poor with no indoor plumbing and no primary education. So is there really a crisis of poverty in America by those standards?
Absolutely there is. If you have been doing what I've been doing in the last few years, and you've been all over the country, there's so many examples. I mean, I met with a woman in Kansas City a couple of years ago who makes $9.50 an hour. She's got several children. I don't remember exactly how many, and works full time. And she told me that she cannot pay her heating bill. Now, this is pretty basic. It's the middle of the winter, and she's working full time and cannot afford to pay her heating, plus pay for food and pay for the other things she needs for her kids. So the story she told me is every night I put my children in their warmest clothes, put every blanket I have on top of them in the bed, ask them to hug each other, and the next morning I get them out of bed and send them off to school, and the last thing I tell them is please, for goodness sakes, don't tell anybody at school about this because they'll come and take you away from me. And then she said to me, I don't understand how in America someone can work full-time and live like that. They shouldn't. And to me, that is an indication. And $9.50 an hour is as low a wage as that is. There are millions of people in this country working for lower wages than that. And I think the bottom line is we have a lot of people who can't feed their kids, pay their bills. They're barely surviving. And if anything goes wrong, they go in the hole. And I think it's contrary to what we believe in this country.
You got a big reaction from the crowd when you mentioned affordable housing. That's certainly a big issue here in New York.
Yes.
And the Bai article says that you would get the federal government out of the business of maintaining housing projects. Now, that would affect hundreds of thousands of people here in New York. Is that your position?
I'm not sure I know what he means by that. I can tell you what I have proposed. What I have proposed is that we create what's happening now with Section 8 housing vouchers, which are affordable housing for low-income families, is most families are waiting anywhere from 2 to 6 or 7 years to get a Section 8 housing voucher. Now, where are they supposed to live in the interim? They're already low income. And if they can't get a Section 8 housing vouchers, many of these families have no place to live. What I propose is that we increase the number of Section 8 housing vouchers by a million. We have a million new housing vouchers. But that we transition from the way we're using the vouchers today. This is the only thing I can think of that he might be referring to. We transition from the way we use the vouchers today, where we cluster poor people together, which is what we've done for decades now, which I believe, and I think most economists believe, feeds the cycle of poverty as opposed to alleviating the cycle of poverty. And instead, we use those vouchers to break down some of the economic and racial barriers that still exist, so that if you're a low-income family, you can use your voucher instead of just to stay where you are, if you choose to go into a better neighborhood, to go into another neighborhood.
So maybe this was an inaccuracy in the article. You're not proposing to stop funding the housing projects, the apartment buildings such as we have
New York. I think what he's talking about is a combination of what I just said. And I did say that I thought there was some significant overhaul that needed to be done at HUD. And that's what I suspect that's what he's talking about.
Right. I'll follow up one more time on this, because New York's Housing Authority is currently engaging in desperate measures like selling off open space like parking lots in the projects to developers, or at least this is proposed now, because of federal funding cuts. And I wonder if you would do something about that as president.
No, of course. We need to, for people who have a place to live, and we don't want to take their housing away from them. The purpose of what I'm proposing is to increase their mobility, to help them, and if they choose to give them the freedom to move to a different place.
Do you have anything else that you would call an urban policy? We are here in New York. Cities have certain needs. Poverty, as you well know, takes certain forms. Do you see the poor people in rural North Carolina as having different specific policy needs as the poor people or then the poor people in New York?
The individual needs are very similar, but the structural needs are different, because when you live in an urban environment, you're faced with different kind of problems. The housing issue I just talked about, the universal health care, I think would apply in both places. I think that particularly inner city schools, we need, in my judgment, besides raising teacher pay generally, which I believe we need to do, I think we also, for teachers who are, especially talented teachers, who are willing to locate in poor inner city neighborhoods to teach, they should get bonus pay. In other words, we want to create an incentive to get our best teachers into the places where we need them the most. That, I think, would make a difference. I think we also want, this applies particularly in urban areas, we also want to, for business and jobs to be created in those places that are indigenous. In other words, business loans and tax credits to businesses that originate in these areas, as opposed to just trying to attract, which we should also do, trying to attract big business to come locate and put jobs there. In other words, you want role models to be established in inner-city urban areas so that kids see a new business starting, an employer who's putting people to work in the neighborhood. I mean, I think that's the kind of example that people need to see.
You know, we have another politician here in New York who wants to make fighting poverty part of his legacy, a politician no longer affiliated with a political party.
I saw that.
Have you looked at Mayor Bloomberg's anti-poverty experiment?
I know a little about it. He's the only part that I have in my head right now, you can remind me, but wasn't he proposing paying families, or if the children
that's a part
don't
of it, paying families to do productive things like take their kids for checkups, have them have good attendance at school, and then even paying the kids if they do well on standardized tests. Any reaction?
I think, in my view, those aren't my ideas, but I think that here's my view about it. Anybody who's in a prominent position in America who's willing to make poverty part of their agenda, no matter what their political party is, I applaud them.
but without a yes or no on that point, I guess.
Well, I don't know enough about his specific policy proposals to embrace
One other thing about the mayor. Daily News columnist Michael Goodwin said on my radio show this morning that Bloomberg may be prepared to spend $1 billion if he runs for president as an independent. That might be four times what the major party candidates can raise. What would that mean for you if you're the nominee?
You mean when I'm the nominee? Well, it's obvious that somebody like Mayor Bloomberg, who has significant wealth, can have a real impact on the process. My own view about it is that we have huge problems with the amount of money that's being spent on presidential campaigns to begin with, and I don't want to sound holier than thou about this. It's not like I don't also raise millions of dollars, because you have to run a serious campaign. But I think the system needs to be changed. I think we ought to publicly finance these campaigns. I think they should be. But the result of the system we have now is that somebody like Mayor Bloomberg, who was willing to spend, what did you say, $1 billion of his own money?
One reporter says.
I mean, he would, without a doubt, he'd get heard. That doesn't mean, as you know, independent candidacies have not fared well in recent years, but it remains to be seen, I think.
More of our interview with John Edwards at the Great Hall of Cooper Union last night in a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Check out our online video picks. Every week we choose five videos from the web, which I anchor in a picks video. This week they include a clip of Michael Moore, who posted on YouTube in conjunction with his new movie Sicko, which I think opens in New York today. It's, of course, about the healthcare system, which we're going to hear about from John Edwards and Mario Cuomo in just a minute. But Sicko posting on the web is Michael Moore asking people to send their own videos or post their own videos on YouTube with your own healthcare horror stories. And we play someone who did. And then we play a response to Michael Moore and Sicko from, of all people, presidential hopeful Fred Thompson. So that's our online video picks at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Well, we're listening to excerpts of my interview with John Edwards last night at Cooper Union, part of the Presidential Candidates Dialogue Series created by former Governor Mario Cuomo with the Great Hall at Cooper Union. And we pick it up where I ask Edwards about his plan for universal health coverage. It's a multifaceted plan that includes some mandates for employers and individuals, some subsidies for those who need them to afford private insurance, and a choice of plans. Later in the hour, we'll take your phone calls on this aspect of Edwards' remarks. But I asked him first about his proposal to pay for the plan, which includes repeal of the Bush tax cuts for people making more than $200,000 a year and possibly raising other taxes on corporations and individuals.
Well, I'm listening to your question very carefully. I have proposed, as part of my health care plan, the rollback of Bush tax cuts for people who make over $200,000 a year. I have also said that I would consider tax increases for very high income individuals, but I haven't proposed it. And I think that's a judgment that we'd have to make.
Would something in particular trigger that as a proposal for you?
Depends on what we need. I think there are structural things in the American economy and in what's happening in America's engagement in the world that have to be dealt with. They are absolutely fundamental to strengthening America over the long term. One you just asked about. I think we desperately need truly universal health care and a reform of our health care system. I think we have a crisis of climate change, global warming, that America has got to lead on. We have to transform the way we use energy in America. I think if we don't find tools, I've talked about some of them tonight, to strengthen the middle class, very specific policy ideas to strengthen the middle class and to lift families out of poverty. That's another, I think, absolute requirement going forward. And then I think there are things America's going to have, given what's the extraordinary degradation in America's standing in the world during the Bush administration. I think that we're going to have to not only end the war in Iraq, which needs to be done, but in addition to that, we're going to have to lead in investing in issues that affect the affect humanity, so that the world sees America as a figure, a force for good again.
And you may have to tax people more to do that. You're saying.
I think it remains to be seen. I don't know the answer to that yet.
Before you got here, Governor Cuomo endorsed what he called real single payer health insurance.
Yeah.
How close is your plan to that?
Well, it's not single payer, but it has a significant component of single payer. Why Governor Cuomo is for single payer. I mean, there's a lot to be said for single payer. It is efficient. It provides services in a way that people usually respond well to. Here's what cheaper. That's what I'm saying. But what my plan does is this. It requires employers to cover their employees or to pay into a fund for coverage. And then everyone in the country would be able to choose their health care. And out of those choices, there is there are private plans and there's a government plan. So if you just picture in your mind's eye, any consumer in America can choose either a private plan or a government plan. The government plan is essentially Medicare Plus. And the idea is that if America chooses that they prefer the government plan, then this plan could clearly go to single payer. There's no doubt about that. But I think this provides some transition period where the American people can adjust to having a universal health care plan. We get everybody covered immediately. We dramatically reduce the cost of the health care system as part of this plan.
You say transition period. So do you see it as a path to single payer? Dennis Kucinich, as you know, says the insurance companies should be seen as outlaws, as vultures trying to take a middleman bite. And he says, just do away with them. Are you saying that your program is a glide path to that?
No, I can't go that far. I think what my plan is gives Americans a choice. They can choose, and they'll have the freedom to choose either the private plan or the plans or the government plan, and we'll see. I think we'll just have to see where that takes us.
On poverty, where does race come into this for any of you? Come into this for you, if at all?
Where does race come into poverty? Poverty in America is largely about race. Shouldn't be shocking to anybody. We lived in a country where for a very long time we embraced slavery. We went from slavery to segregation. We went from segregation to extraordinary discrimination. And even today, discrimination is, although sometimes slightly below the surface, is still rampant. And so I think that when you look at everything from income levels, let's just take asset levels. This goes health care, access to health care, all those things. But let's just pick out assets. I mean, if you're I won't have these numbers exactly right, but if you're a white family, the average white family in America has a net worth of $80,000, $85,000, and the average African-American family has an average net worth of somewhere between $6,000 and $8,000. It's about 10 times. And the same thing is largely true of Latino families. That gap means something in people's lives, and it's not an accident.
So because of this income gap and asset gap and because of the very the unique race-specific discrimination in our history that you were describing, do you therefore support any kind of race-specific remedies? And would you even talk about reparations, or is that a dirty word for you?
I'm not for reparations, but what I am for is and a strong supporter of is affirmative action, so that we... And I'm also for an array of government programs that allocate a certain percentage to minority-owned businesses. I think those kind of tools are important. When the University of Michigan case was in the United States Supreme Court, I personally filed a brief in support of the University of Michigan's affirmative action program. When you're like me and you grew up with... I was born in 1953 in South Carolina. I lived my whole youth in South Carolina, Georgia, and North Carolina. So I saw discrimination up close, and I know the impact it had on many of my dear friends when I was growing up. And I guess I feel a huge personal responsibility to try to deal with issues of race and inequality in America, and I think they are still there.
Do we need any new anti-discrimination laws or better enforcement of any specific ones?
We need, you mean on the issue of race?
Correct.
I think that what we have, which have been diminished under the Bush administration, but we need enforcement of, we need to, first of all, promote affirmative action. Second, we need a serious enforcement from the Justice Department and others on issues like protecting people's voting rights and the suppression of people's right to vote. I think we have a justice system that has huge inherent biases against people of color. That includes some of which are actually written into the law, the disparity between crack and powder cocaine, which has a huge impact on young African-American men. I think, listen, I used to be in the court system. I know how it works. If you are black in America, you're more likely to get charged with a crime, you're more likely to be convicted of a crime, and you're more likely to get a more severe sentence. It is not an accident that our prisons are filled with people of color. And I think that we have a responsibility to do multiple things. One is to go into the root causes of what gets young people of color into that system to begin with, and there are lots of components of that. But I think we also have a responsibility to engage in a serious evaluation of our justice system to see what we can do to make it work in a more equal, fair way for people of color who participate in it.
Does your concern about... Does your concern about poverty and wages inform your position on the immigration debate? Some people say one thing to do about low wages is reduce the labor supply, and especially reduce the competition for low-skill African Americans in cities like New York, who lose out to low-skill immigrants who often, for reasons of discrimination, employers prefer to hire.
Well, first, I would say that I think the evidence is widely varying on the impact that illegal immigration has had on wages in America. The academic studies are very divided on this question. So I think there's a serious factual question about whether immigrant workers are driving down wages. But there's not a moral question. And it seems to me that the moral answer is very simple. And that is, we do not want to live in an America made up of first-class citizens and second-class laborers. That's not the kind of country we should live in. And I think that... So I think for that reason, there has to be... Now, I think it could go path to citizenship, but it should be combined with a number of other things, including much better job on our borders, much better job of enforcement against employers knowingly hiring illegal immigrants and abusing them in many cases.
But as far as the effects of the extent of legal and illegal immigration combined on wages, which is one of your key issues, you're saying the jury is out factually and you're going to go with the immigrants.
I'm going to go with treating human beings with dignity and respect. That's what I'm going to go with.
You haven't mentioned I'm not saying you've never mentioned it. You haven't mentioned it tonight. Single parenthood as a factor in poverty. And conservatives especially say that's statistically the number one factor
for children. I didn't hear the first thing you said.
I said that you haven't mentioned, at least tonight, single parenthood as a factor in child poverty.
Yes.
And conservatives especially say that statistically that's really the number one association with poverty, and it's so many more children than it was a generation or two ago. Where does that fit in for you?
I think there is a this is a piece of it. I think that there is a cultural / societal component to the cycle of poverty. I believe that. I do believe that's true. I didn't come here to sell books, but I had a book come out a few weeks ago called Ending Poverty in America that I edited along with a couple of my colleagues at the University of North Carolina. And we have lots of people who contributed to the book, but this subject, this whole general subject is discussed in the book. What I believe is that, and I think this is the problem with the conservatives you refer to, is they want to make this all about that issue. They want to make it all about culture. This is all culture. That's all it is. You know, even though people are working for $6 an hour, it's all culture. Even though people have no health care, it's all culture. Even though people don't have a decent place to live, it's all culture. You know, the honest answer, I think, is that there are many, poverty is a multifactorial thing. And I think each of these things contribute. And it is true that that children who grow up in particularly larger families with one parent have a significantly higher chance of living in poverty. That's true.
Do you have any major initiatives to fight single parenting, not as a cultural matter, but as an economic matter for poor children?
Yeah, I mean, a stricter enforcement of child support laws, and also I mentioned earlier these mentoring programs for young men who are in low income areas. I think anything that generates responsibility and hope and opportunity for the future helps with those problems.
As you see it, did the welfare reform of 1996, ending welfare as we knew it, help or hurt poor people, or some of each?
Well, I don't accept that. I don't accept that way of thinking about it. I think that I think first of all there were flaws, serious flaws
in the law,
in the welfare and reform law. There was not enough effort put into job training, making sure that people didn't go off welfare and just go to work, but they had some upward mobility in the jobs that they were able to obtain, that they had decent and affordable child care, that they had transportation to get to work. I think there were the infrastructure that was necessary to make this work was not fleshed out the way it needed to be. And I think on top of that, it had very little impact on young African-American men. I mean, the work rate and poverty rate on young African-American men did not improve as a result. So it was largely aimed at women of color. And it did have some positive effects there. But having said that, if you look at some of the writing that's been done, I'm blanking on his name right now, but the New York Times reporter who wrote the book, I believe the name of it is The American Dream, about the families that moved from Chicago to Milwaukee, and he tracked what was happening to them
right,
while welfare.
Jason DePaul.
Yes, Jason DePaul. Thank you. You can see that did it help people go to work? Yes. Did their lives change significantly? Not a lot. And so getting people to work is a good thing. We want people who are capable of working to be working, but they have to, number one, have the support system for their families that they need, and number two, they have to have jobs that have an opportunity to advance.
Let me end with a couple of political questions drawn from the Matt Bye article. He reminds us of the politics of middle class and poor, that middle class Americans often haven't seen their interests aligned with programs for the poor because they felt that they were being taxed for other people's irresponsible behavior. Can you make a case tonight for middle-class Americans to feel that their interests and those of poor Americans are more aligned today than they were, say, in the Reagan years?
Yes. I would say to them several things. Number one, if you want to live in an America where what you saw in the lower Ninth Ward of New Orleans when the hurricane hit is not okay, where you think that's immoral for people to live under circumstances like that where they have no chance of having a better life, we can do something about that. That's number one. Number two, the thing we're going to do is we're going to give them a chance to help themselves. This is not about using your money to just take care of them. People who are who are capable of working need to work. You're working, they should work. But they should be able to earn a decent wage, to be able to support their families, and have their kids live in a safe environment. So I would say, first, it is a moral issue, but the moral imperative is to give them a real chance and knock down the obstacles that stand in front of them. These are for those who can take care of themselves. And then I would say what I'm proposing, everything from strengthening the right of unions to organize to raising the minimum wage to I have this college for everyone idea for kids who are willing to work when they're in college, helping them with their tuition. All these things are value-based. They're based on people helping themselves and working hard. And if we can lift millions of families out of poverty, what will happen is the American economy will be stronger. You will see economic growth. It will impact you directly. But I don't think that's the most powerful argument. I think it's true, but I don't think that's the most powerful argument. I think the most powerful argument is a combination of giving them a chance. Giving them a chance. Nobody should live as just a second-class citizen because of the family they're born into or the color of their skin. And this is about giving them a chance, and that's something every American should have.
And again, politically speaking, and drawing from the Bay article, he calls you a Twilight in America Democrat, focusing on the need for protection from our decline rather than a Morning in America type, optimistic about our possibilities, which tends to play better in presidential races. Do you accept that label?
No, he's dead wrong. I think first of all, it is impossible for me not to be optimistic. I mean, when you've had the kind of blessings that I've had in my life, and we're like anybody, we've had some struggles that are obvious, I guess, but we have had huge blessings. Elizabeth and I both have had huge blessings in our lives. I mean, there's no way to not be relentlessly optimistic. But I feel a personal responsibility. I do. I mean, it's more important to me than any politics. I feel a personal responsibility for all those millions of people in this country who want that same kind of chance to have it. They ought to have that chance. That's what America's supposed to be about. And I can tell you, whatever the politics are, whether I'm running for office, whether I'm president of the United States, or whether I'm just living in North Carolina, as long as I'm alive and breathing, I'm going to speak out for America doing something about the poor.
Presidential hopeful John Edwards. That took place last night, that interview, at the Great Hall at Cooper Union. And as we mentioned earlier, the event was part of a Cooper Union Presidential Hopefuls Dialogue series created by former Governor Mario Cuomo to go deeply into various issues. Their next guest will be Rudy Giuliani at the Great Hall in September. But I actually want to contrast something right now that Edwards said in that interview with something that Governor Cuomo himself said in his introductory remarks, and then take your calls on this. It's about how to cover everyone with health care. We heard about Edwards' multifaceted plan there, but here's what Cuomo had said just before Edwards spoke.
My opinion, we need single-payer health care, real single-payer health care. And I think if you listen closely, most people will not say single-payer health care. Why? Because they're afraid people will misunderstand. Single-payer, that's socialism. What are you talking about, socialism? Who told you that? Single-payer, well, that's the government's going to pay, right? Yes. So single-payer is socialism. Oh, you mean if the government pays, that's socialism. Good. Where does your kid go to school? PS 50. That's socialism.
All right. So Governor Cuomo last night. And here's what we'll do. We will open up the phones now for your calls on single payer yes or single payer no. 212-433-WNYC. And don't be insulted or think you're being censored if we bump you, because we're going to save half our lines for single payer yes and half our lines for single payer no. This is not a poll. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And again, if you joined that Edwards interview late, here's a little bit of what he said after I referred to Cuomo's single payer endorsement.
What my plan does is this. It requires employers to cover their employees or to pay into a fund for coverage. And then everyone in the country would be able to choose their health care. And out of those choices, there is there are private plans and there's a government plan. So if you just picture in your mind's eye, any consumer in America can choose either a private plan or a government plan. The government plan is essentially Medicare Plus. And the idea is that if America chooses that they prefer the government plan, then this plan could clearly go to single payer.
So I think what we heard from Edwards between the lines there was that someone who thinks he or she has a real chance to be elected president, like him, still generally does not feel politically comfortable embracing single payer. And we heard Cuomo say why. He's going to be called a communist. And sure enough, Giuliani in the last Republican debate called the Democratic healthcare plans socialism. So Edwards' hedge is that with a government option in the mix of choices, people may gravitate to government single payer, but that'll be up to them, and that's as close as he'll come. So we're going to take your calls. There are obviously some real reasons that people don't want single payer, and some real reasons that people like Governor Cuomo do. So the lines are open. Half our lines for single payer yes, half our lines for single payer no. 212-433-WNYC. We'll take your calls on the air in a minute.